So today we continue our series of the Sermon on the Mount, that series of lessons in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7 that really capitalize the absolute essence of Jesus' teachings. And as we do so, our sources are the same as they've been for a while. Two primary sources for this series are The Secret According to Jesus, Living a Joyful Life by Reverend Ed Townley, and The Sermon on the Mount by Reverend Emmett Fox. And, you know, Jesus, right now, I guess we'll say we're at the very heart, what I would consider to be the heart of the Sermon on the Mount. And this is where Jesus employs one of his most effective, I believe, teaching techniques. It is the phrase, "You have heard it said, but I say to you." The tone is gentle, but the teachings are revolutionary, designed to take his disciples gathered on that mountaintop, overlooking the beautiful Sea of Galilee, from the old law of Moses to a new dimension of spiritual understanding. Jesus knows very well that his message is going to shock and has already shocked his disciples, and he lovingly guides him through the teachings by telling them he has not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. Jesus continues, "Again, you have heard it said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill it to the Lord, the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven or for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black." Actually, today, literally, that isn't true, but we'll go on. "All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from evil." And we know metaphysically evil means error. Now, interestingly, factual or traditional, I should say, interpretation of this, and you can Google the internet and you'll find this all over the place, is that it's a commandment to tell the truth. However, if we take another look, that's not really what Jesus says, is it? Jesus says, "But I tell you what," say it with me, "do not swear an oath at all." Of course, the disciples at the time would have realized it's not a good thing to break an oath, but Jesus takes this, as usual, to a new level. In the words of Emmett Fox, Jesus says, "Swear not at all," and he means, "Do not make any future oaths. Do not make any future oaths." In the time of Jesus now, people made oaths or promises by saying, "I swear by heaven above," or "I swear by holy Jerusalem," or "I swear by the hair of my head." You can see these reflected in the verse. Swearing on one's mother's grave was also popular. I'm not sure where that came from, but it was popular. And while we may not use that language today, we still do make all sorts of oaths, many of which we break. How many of us have decreed, "I swear I will eat more healthy, be more organized, and have more patience," think New Year's resolutions, right? Or, "I swear I will never again," fill in the blank, right? I have for years, personally, for years said I would never buy a red car. Well, my new car is due to arrive this week, and three guesses what color it is. Are you ready for this? Ruby, flare, pearl. That's the color. I can't decide if I'm going to call her ruby or pearl, but it will come to me, okay? The point is that when I made that oath, for years, I meant it. But later, I opened my mind to a new possibility. And sometimes we make promises to one another that we also break. Ways like, "I will stop working so many hours," or "I promise to end a relationship or a habit that is destroying my friendship or my marriage." Fox notes that oaths like these can actually be manipulative, driven by the ego, and designed to control others. Now, the pattern here in all these oaths seems to be that most of our promises are about outer acts, and in contrast, Spiritual growth, one of our core values, is not ever about outer behavior. It is a process of self-discovery and inner growth. So Emmett Fox has an interesting interpretation of this teaching of Jesus. Emmett Fox writes, Jesus is saying that you are not to mortgage your future conduct in advance. To undertake, to do, or to refrain from doing something tomorrow, or next year, or the next 30 years from now. He says, do not fix your belief on tomorrow when it is still today. In other words, he is advocating what so many spiritual leaders say today, and what a divine coincidence, it is in the Daily Word today, he is advocating to live in the now moment. Fox says a vital part of Jesus' teachings for us is to seek direct inspiration from the God of our being moment by moment, constantly keeping ourselves open channels for all that God is. And if we cannot do that possibly if our minds are made up in advance about, these are Fox's words, what we shall or shall not do, how we shall or shall not believe, how we shall or shall not be tomorrow or next year or for the rest of our lives. To stay focused on spiritual growth and enlightenment, we need to be open hearts and open minds to revising, enlarging, and expanding in consciousness. And Jesus summarizes all this teaching with a very poignant comment. He says, and we'll explore this later, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Everything else is from evil, is from error. Most of our energy directed toward future oaths and promises is error thinking and therefore wasted energy. We use the power of yes in the present moment to declare what is spiritually true, right? That's what an affirmation is. We affirm love, harmony, peace, and the omnipresence of God as the one reality. We use the power of no to deny that any person or outer circumstance has power over us, right? That's what a denial is. And affirmations and denials are always made in the present tense. We can't really say yes or no to the past because it's done. We can't really say yes or no to the future because it's yet to be. We receive the inspiration of the divine in this now moment. No oaths necessary. So Jesus goes on. Next he says, you have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, offer no resistance to the one who is evil or in error. When someone strikes you on your right cheek, turn the other one to him as well. If anyone goes to court to take your tunic, hand over your cloak as well. Should anyone press you into service for 1 mile, go with him for 2 miles. Give to the one who asks of you, and do not turn your back on one who wants to borrow from you. Now, history tells us that this old law that Jesus refers to here had its origins in 1780 BCE when the king of Babylon set down a code of conduct. It was carved in stone, placed in the city square, and based on retribution. This has been called the law of retaliation. And the principle is when a person has injured another, he or she is to be penalized in the same degree. And, are you ready for this? The person inflicting such punishment should be the actual injured party. Now, to be fair, the Torah tried to regulate fair punishment so the punishment for violence would not exceed the injury, because sometimes it did. When the person retaliating went overboard with the revenge. Gandhi, I don't know for sure if Gandhi said this. He's credited for saying it, but here it is. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth makes the world blind and toothless. Ed Townley says this primitive form of justice is based on ego survival, and it was sufficient for a time when humankind was in wilderness consciousness. Once again here, Jesus is taking the disciples and us to a new dimension of spiritual understanding, that we grow into full expression of our divine identity, and then we must embrace a new perspective. Jesus teaches, resist not evil or error. This teaching has a modern term also. It is called non-resistance. We discussed a few weeks ago in another teaching on the Sermon on the Mount his language about turning the other cheek. It does not mean, as some say, to allow ourselves to become victims of abuse. Jesus would never advocate that. Metaphysically, it means to give back a different form of energy, turn from the appearance to the greater reality of truth, to unfold in light and love every negative interaction, gently dissolving resentments by the light of our true essence. Martin Luther King, a pioneer of non-resistance, said, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that." This means in the face of darkness, we are to be the light. In the face of hatred, we are to be the love. In the face of discord, we are to be the peace. Another great master of non-resistance, the Dalai Lama, said, "Don't let the behavior of others destroy your inner peace. It is our power, it is our divine inheritance, and we cannot give it away." Next, Jesus' comment about going the extra mile is a little odd to us, but it would have been especially shocking to his disciples, because we remember at the time Jesus was teaching these lessons, Romans occupied most of the Mediterranean world, and Roman soldiers were all over Palestine. One of the practices that was most hated by the Jews was that of Roman soldiers forcing Jewish males to carry their military packs for the distance of 1 mile. That was actually written in law that the Roman soldiers could do that. Now, of course, the Jews hated this public humiliation, but they were powerless to stop it. So Jesus is telling his disciples, instead of begrudging the Roman soldier the mile of demanded service, go the second mile. The first mile may be forced, but the second mile is a gift freely given. This is classic non-resistance. Just like in turning the other cheek, the energy is completely shifted. And Townley writes, "The soldier who had been dominant thanks to the power of Rome is now the recipient of a gift thanks to the power of love. And now the oppressed has become the gift giver, and that is an expression of God's love." Townley continues, "Non-resistance remains a powerful social political attitude in the world today, and it represents the clearest path to the kingdom of heaven in our individual lives as well." And I think he means by this when we truly know and live from the knowing that there is only one presence, one power, one energy, we are not going to resist error in this outer world. Instead of wasting time, energy, and strength on anger and retribution, we release the struggle and allow divine harmony, peace, and love to flow through us and out into the world. And next, Jesus explains what love looks like when we are in oneness with God. I don't know if you can see this from the back. I had a really hard time finding the language I wanted, so I'll read it to you, but I hope you can see it. It's from Matthew 5, 43-48. "You have heard it said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust." Some translations say on the righteous and the unrighteous. "For if you love only those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you salute only your brethren, only your own family and friends, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You, therefore, must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Well, throughout his ministry, Jesus will emphasize the energy of love as the new law. The old ego-based survival consciousness to love your neighbor and hate your enemy was sufficient for its time. But Jesus comes to teach his disciples and us a new code for living, just a new identity based on our divine essence. And in the full dimension of our oneness with God, we realize that we're also one with all humankind, no matter where they are. Every man, woman, and child on this earth is our neighbor. Now, in the New Testament, there are many names for love in different verses. In this particular teaching, the word is not translated as eros, which means romantic love. Jesus is not talking about romantic love here. It's not philios, which means family love. He's not talking about family and friend love here, although those are blessings we have in our lives for sure. But Jesus is talking about a different kind of love. It is the Greek word agape, meaning pure, unconditional love, Christ love, the love of our Christ essence. Now, Jesus tells us that God causes the sun to rise and the rain to fall on the righteous and the unrighteous alike. Well, darn. That doesn't seem fair, does it? But Jesus reminds us that divine love, agape love, is no respecter of persons. Our co-founder, Charles Fillmore, says, divine love loves for the sake of loving. It is not concerned with what or who it loves, nor with expectation of love returned. Like the sun, its joy is the shining forth of its own nature. Anne Lamott wrote, "You can safely assume that you've created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people you hate." Great quote. God is love. God cannot hate. That's a human trait, a human habit. I shouldn't say trait, a human habit. Jesus is explaining that to love our so-called enemies, we don't even have to have personal affection for them. We can reserve that for our friends and family. We don't have to approve of their behavior or condone wrongdoing. We simply have to behold the Christ in them, see them as capable of good, and deserving our compassion. That's what agape love is all about. And what about Jesus' reference here to the tax collectors and the Gentiles? Well, to the disciples, it would have been crystal clear, that meaning. Tax collectors were especially despised in Jesus' day because they were Jews collecting taxes for the Romans, for the hated Romans. And the term Gentiles simply means non-believers in the one true God. We forget sometimes that in the time of Jesus, the whole rest of the world was polytheistic. They were worshiping all sorts of gods and goddesses. And metaphysically, the word Gentile means strictly in human consciousness. So Jesus is saying, these people, the tax collectors and those just in human consciousness, extend love only for what they will get back in return. Maybe some of us have known people like that, right? Ed Townley writes, "What Jesus is asking us to give up is the idea of reciprocity. You know that I'll love you if, that conditional human love, I'll love you forever if you bring me homemade chocolate chip cookies, right? Or if you bring me coffee in the morning, or if you forgive this or that or the other. Actually, sometimes the stakes are a little higher than this, as we might know. The point is, we are here to be God's love unconditionally, not based on what people do back for us. And Ed Townley says, in order to do that, we must follow what Jesus will advocate throughout his entire ministry. Judge not. Judge not. In order to love all humankind, not just our friends and family, we must release that strictly human tendency to judge others. In truth, there's no way we can ever really know the heart, the intentions, the story of another human being. I couldn't find a definitive source for this quote, but I love it. It is, "Don't judge my story by the chapter you walked in on." Isn't that perfect? I love it. I would like to give a person credit for that, but I couldn't find it. Maybe some of you can find it. And I have to say, how ironic that we're talking today about love your neighbor and love your enemy as yourself and non-judgment. Because the horrific shooting yesterday in Pittsburgh is a startling consequence of holding negative judgments about an entire religious and cultural group. Judgments turn to hatred, and hatred results in violence. Hatred in the heart of one man led to the deaths of 11 people and several others injured, including police officers who rushed to the scene to help the injured. Reports say that the shooter ran into a peaceful place of worship on the Sabbath during a baby naming ceremony, and he was shouting, "All Jews must die." And what are we to do right here, right now, with that hate and horror? What are we to do? We can do only one thing. We are here to love. Early last evening, over 3,000 people of all faiths, all creeds, gathered to hold a vigil, singing, praying, honoring the victims, and giving loving support to the grieving survivors. We are on this earth to be God's love and expression, no matter what. We are not on this earth to destroy with our hatred. We are on this earth to transform with our love. And Jesus ends this treatise on love with a timely comment that has puzzled people for centuries. It is, "Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." To be perfect may seem like a tall order. All of us, I think, have moments that we don't feel too perfect, right? Or is it just, maybe it's just me, I don't know. But the word translated as perfect in the Greek did not mean free of faults. It didn't mean that at all. It meant whole and complete. So really what Jesus is saying here is, "Be ye complete as your heavenly Father is complete." Perfection is the truth of who we are. The ability to express true, perfect love is within all of us. It's part of our DNA. And as we know our oneness with Spirit, we make loving, non-judgmental choices, and God's love is perfected in us and out into the world. We steadfastly create the kingdom of heaven, moment by moment, thought by thought, prayer by prayer, as we express the love that God is. Next week, we will continue exploring the Sermon on the Mount, but for now, let us affirm the presence and power that is the source of all divine love. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life: God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life: God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.